Good afternoon. I know that people actually are wondering if we do have plugs for their computers. We do actually have them at the front, so I'd really appreciate if you can move towards the inner circle. In case you're afraid that your laptop might die at the back, please, just so that we can have a sort of more consolidated conversation. We're going to start just around now. Good. I hope you had a good break, nice lunch, enjoyed the sun for those that went out. It's a glorious and beautiful day. So, this last session, just before lunch, I think we had some really exciting and sort of stimulating conversation. In fact, to some extent, I felt as if I just stopped people in their tracks and cut their thought processes. So I'm sure there's a lot of things that emerge from your dialogues, your conversations in different teams, etc. But what I want to say is in this next session, we're going to have a very interactive session. I'm going to come to the middle. And so please feel free. We have some interventions planned, which I'm going to announce. There's some people in the room who want to make some prepared interventions from their organizations of governments. But we did capture some of the thoughts and discussions from the last session. And there's quite a lot of rich, rich information that's emerging. And I also just want to remind people that a lot, in fact, if not most of what's coming out of this last day and today is obviously informing the climate change negotiating process. So please do bear that in mind. And you need to really be informing this process ultimately. I shall move to the center. And I think if I can ask the secretariat if they can load that presentation, please. Thank you, Ronnie. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Hello, hello.
Great, it's working now. So we have five slides in terms of some of the thoughts that we've captured, and I know there's still quite a bit missing here, but we shall begin. So NAPS can help different ministries and actors to view climate change not only as a challenge, but also an opportunity to secure more financing for development. Is that a reality? Is that something that's happening? And this is something that we'd like to hear from you. Next slide, please. So NAP as a process can support integration in development planning processes, but the only results may ultimately be seen in other documents, e.g. national development plans. Next. A legal framework can provide very clear guidelines in terms of what the national and subnational governments can do. And I'm sure that some governments in the House and people coming from civil society in the respective countries where they work perhaps have had this experience. Is that something that's coming to fruition? This is something that we may discuss in the next hour and a half. And then here it talks about the NAP process itself. So NAP can facilitate the engagement of all stakeholders, similar to the first point, from the development planners to DRR groups and to the most vulnerable communities. This seemed to emerge. And lastly, but not the least, I presume, strategy to mobilize resources to ensure effective implementation of the three agendas. So the NAP process can be, and to some extent, potentially, I think, is being used as a strategy to mobilize resources to ensure effective implementation. So, based on these points that we captured from the last conversation, I want to kick off this next session. So we have quite a bit of time, and please feel free to tell us what's happening, keeping in mind that we want to hear about the opportunities, the challenges that you're experiencing in your countries, and also just thinking through in terms of, you know, maybe challenges from a finance perspective or even opportunities from a finance perspective, from a technological element. And also would like to get some recommendations from you. What recommendations and next steps, particularly not just for the technical paper that we're developing, but also input into the negotiation process. So I shall open the floor. And please give your name, tell us what your affiliation or government you're coming from, and what your contribution is. Please tell us your experiences, your opportunities, what challenges you're facing in your respective areas. And then after a bit of interacting, I'm going to request there's some people in this room who've prepared interventions, and then they can go ahead. So over to you. Shall I take the discretion to point fingers and call people out? Please, the lady from Sri Lanka. If you can introduce yourself, please.
Vasita from Sri Lanka. So going back to the questions, I think I'll answer some of them, not all of them. So how development planning could work with the NAPS? So Sri Lanka did a national adaptation plan, but then SDG process was not necessarily overlapping with it because we started working. Let's just keep the SDGs aside. So when we developed the national adaptation plan in Sri Lanka, we took the sectors which would go into development planning. So it is reflected, some of these issues that are priorities for development are reflected in the NAP in Sri Lanka, and also it complements the NDCs. So there aren't any clashes per se, but then when the development changes or the priorities change depending on government priorities, then there needs to be certain changes that need to happen with the NAP. It cannot be as it is when it was done 2 years ago when we finalized it and we launched it last year. So there will be certain changes we have to do when we are implementing it, or we take it as a rolling plan, that what we have now. So there needs to be flexibility that is there, open in an app that could feed into priorities of a country when its development priorities. In terms of stakeholder engagement, we have engaged most stakeholders in our process of developing the NAP. There was civil society engagement as well as academic and experts of different fields that engaged. There were 9 sectors, if I'm not mistaken, that we focused on. And then there is also how this could go into other local actors and multiple other actors that are not necessarily who are involved in the process that we are looking into, because there's an NGO forum that's being included in the NAP of Sri Lanka, which we are looking into developing. And DRR groups, some of the actors, NGOs and civil society actors, work on DRR, loss and damage, as well as climate change. So there were people who are engaging in Sendai framework, or experts at least on SDGs and DRR sectors that were engaging in the process. And going to the legal frameworks, Sri Lanka is currently working on a legal framework for climate change. So NAP would be part of it, or at least the priorities of adaptation would be part of it. And this goes in line with the NDC implementation that we are looking for next in the couple of years. So there's readiness plan that is being done for NDC implementation, which again is fed through the NAP process that we engaged in the last few years. So what I'm saying now is something as it is now, but it could change depending on how we work forward. So these are the few input I can give on the questions you've raised.
Thank you so much. I think just listening to you, I hear and also having listened to a number of people in the room this morning, I realize that actually we're talking about a living document. So it's dynamic. We have to update it and make sure that, you know, obviously it's getting reviewed and updated. And also something that you raise now, which is quite important, is the role of civil society groups in making sure that, you know, there's a kind of a coordinated voice and the whole element of sharing information across these different sectors. Is there anyone else in the room that may have an experience to share what opportunities you've seen, and either from a financing, technological perspective, et cetera? What has worked in your opinion, and what do you think, you know, should be the opportunities that we tap into? Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel I really would like to comment on a few of those many aspects you asked us to address in the context of NUPS. And I will start with some easy ones. And this is the one that ultimately the results of a NUP may be seen in other documents, like national development plans. And I feel that would match perfectly with the idea of integration and of mainstreaming. So I feel I would not mind if adaptation activities are done and reflected in other plans. This is not really a problem. However, when it comes to the challenge that whether a NUP can, can inform legal framework with a clear guideline in terms of what the national and the subnational government should do, I feel, at least from the Austrian perspective where I come from, this is an issue which is very heavy. It points to the constitution of the country, and it would take a very long time. And we try, of course, to, I would say, make our governance more efficient and effective, because during the years a lot of overlaps and so on have been established, but it is very unlikely that the NUP will have any significant impact on this institutional setting. We should not overload.
So whilst you're actually talking right now, Thomas, I mean, my question to you therefore is, in the Austrian case, and this is, we're talking about a developed region here and a country, and so where is the NUP in itself anchored legally?
You know, the NUP is in the responsibility of the Ministry of Environment.
Okay.
And it, you know, it was built, so to say, starting with the bottom-up process, where all possible actions related to adaptation have been collected in the first step from the private sector, from regional level, from community level. And then there were, you know, very open stakeholder processes linked to various sectors that are vulnerable, like tourism, mm-hmm. or like energy, or like settlements, or natural risks with avalanches or floods and so on. So there were a range of sectors, vulnerable sectors engaged, and there was a very broad and informal exchange of views, and everything was documented, and we designed also some monitoring and evaluation, and there will be an evaluation on the progress, but it is not linked to a very strict legal guidance, and it's not a legal requirement, but it's a more, you know, voluntary participation in the process, and people that are convinced we need to adapt, they will do so. But of course, this kind of cooperation cannot really prevent maladaptation, for instance.
Of course. I'm very curious to hear about other countries in the House, because this is a very interesting setup. Did I see your name? Yes, please.
Yes, thank you. Well, I'd like to tell you a bit more about experience in the Netherlands. We started some years ago, not with an official NEP, but with a so-called Delta program, because our situation in the Netherlands is that we are a low-lying country, and, well, we are aware of our position in relation to our coastal zone, river management, and the whole water situation. And, well, when we started that program, we did it together with the different layers on national, regional, and local level, but we established also a special legal framework. We called it the so-called Delta Act. In that act, we described the process of the Delta program. We laid down the funding for 20 years, And we had also for the governance different directives, but also a special vicar, the so-called Delta Commissioner. And he is, or she, at the moment, he is responsible for the whole process and has also responsibility to the parliament to report yearly about the progress of this whole process. And I think when this legal work, legal framework is working, that we know that there is progress, and if there is a kind of hiccups, it will be also on the political level what happened and why, what can we do on it. So it helps us to keep rolling on with the whole process, mm-hmm. and especially also for the funding, it is very safe that we have a long-term investment for our implementation. Mm-hmm. So, well, this is an example for a special legal framework for this program.
Thank you very much. It's quite insightful because we have two European community countries that have two different approaches of how they're actually going to deal with the quote-unquote legality of making sure that adaptation, and particularly the national adaptation process, and also your entry point from the deltaic dynamic, because being a low-lying country and the delta system, it's really, really interesting. I'm really curious, my counterpart from SPREP, from Samoa, please, if you can tell us your experience or an addition or something.
Well, I wanted to say that we've been looking at NAPS as a process, and I think we need to look at it as a process from the outset. So it should be the National Adaptation Process, not the National Adaptation Plan, when you talk about it in capitals. The NAP, perhaps, is really just one of the outputs from doing the process. It's there's a need to both institutionalize this and mainstream it. You heard from Sione from Tonga about how they've been doing that, and that's very much how most of that's the sort of the process that most of the countries in the region are going through.
So the good thing is we get to keep the P.
Yeah, you can have lowercase NAPs for the actual plan, perhaps. There are some prerequisites. So you need to have tools and capacity support. If you're going to be creating a process, it does require things like databases and having a sort of a singular information system where so that it doesn't become a burden. You have to have single data entries for different aspects of adaptation. And if you make it simple and automated, then it'll become easier to use. And also, in looking at what sort of support countries will be needing in order to do this, I mean, this also relates to what sort of legal framework mm-hmm. You will require. This becomes very country-specific at that point, particularly in the Pacific with about four different colonial legacies. Now, we've in my organization, together with other agencies, we have developed a number of tools to assist. So we have environmental impact assessment tools, we have cost-benefit analysis, gender toolkit, and even working on the database system, we have what we call the vanilla version because it doesn't have any any color to it. But we're trying to develop systems that would grab the information that's needed from already entered data. So trying to look at practical ways to respond to the issues that are up on the screen, we think we're going in the right direction, but it does require resources and support. And it does require also a bit of country specificity. The approach, I think, can be similar to most countries, but the actual activities and actions will require very much a country specificity.
Thank you. As it's a process, as you rightly put it, are we seeing some of these elements in those 5 points that were captured from the conversation early? Are we seeing therefore that this is in a way providing an opportunity for integration of the 2015 global processes or agendas? Yes, please. Please, if you can introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you. I'm Stefan Baas from FAO. And I would like to add to the discussion a bit a sectoral perspective. I cannot give or don't want to give a specific country perspective, but how all this planning may be or is perceived from the agricultural sectors in several countries, in which over the last 5 years, this is more than 15 countries where we have facilitated the development of sector-specific disaster risk reduction and climate change adaptation plans. And what we observe there from the sectoral line agencies is a kind of a fatigue that they tell us there are so many important agendas. All of them require their own planning. And within the sectors in agriculture, shall we develop a specific plan for NAPS, for the NDC implementation, for Sendai, for UN Women Equity, Gender Equity, for UNCCD, to name only a few. This all comes to the sectors, and the sectors say, no, we cannot. In this regard, I appreciated very, very much this idea of integration. Mm-hmm. And I have the feeling that in the group work this morning, we went a step too quick, and we lost a little bit about a discussion of the architecture of the different planning instruments and planning requirements, particularly if it goes beyond the cross-sectoral planning,
yes,
at horizontal level towards the vertical planning from the national level to the local levels, where, and this is my entry point, the sectors actually have to play a key role. So I wonder if it's only, and this relates to the question of our working group before, is it only the NAPS which would be used as a planning instrument to also inform the sustainable development agenda? And I would say no. There is also the Sendai planning, and we heard yesterday that countries are committed by 2020 to also develop their and submit their DRR Sendai strategies. So to reopen the discussion in line with the previous speakers from Austria, I think, on considering whether all this work may also culminate in the sectoral or in the socio-economic development plans of the countries. And I would like to reopen, if possibly, this discussion and invite some countries, maybe from the sectoral perspectives, how do they cope with these requirements and what does the NAPS and other planning documents actually add in terms of value to them and not as a burden.
Great. Thank you so much, Stefan, for that intervention. I think it's really critical that you actually, we're now opening Pandora's box, and would like to hear from the governments in the House, if there are any, and I'm sure there are many. Please, we want to hear your experiences, because we don't want to extra burden you, because already this, in some cases it's happening, in some cases it's not happening. I have just a quick request. I understand there's an intervention on the floor from counterpart from the GCF, I suppose. Yes, please. Sorry, I have your back against you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. Thank you very much. And thank you to all colleagues for allowing us to provide a little bit of input as to what the status of financing adaptation and this question of linkages at the GCF. First and foremost, I would take the opportunity to once again, and in the context of this conversation, stress that we, as part of the larger programming process at the GCF, we see that a lot of these issues in the room that we have provided for support for the process to formulate NAPS can be addressed there. We hope that the proposals that we receive for the formulation of NAPS and other adaptation planning processes will be addressing country priorities. And to the extent that these things are country priorities, the GCF will continue to be responsive to this. We, in the context of NAPS, see a set of different outcomes that are very much in line with the technical guidelines that were received, that were developed under the convention with regards to NAPS. And what we hope to see as outcomes are those things that relate to strong system of governance and coordination for adaptation planning, assessment and analysis, management of knowledge and information, policy and strategy development, strong financing action plan, and monitoring and learning. And basically, as long as in how countries wish to think of linking their adaptation with whether it is SDGs or whatever countries are prepared to put on the as their priorities. We think that these outcomes that we expect to see under NAPs are compatible. The other point that might be useful to raise is actually, remember that very much in line with what's being discussed here, NAP is definitely is a process. It's not an end in itself. Mm-hmm. We don't want documents sitting on shelves to consider that the great outcome of this investment, which, to clarify, it's up to $3 million per country for the formulation of NAPs. But when it comes to actual the investment in the implementation of those NAPs, in the implementation, the thresholds are actually much higher at the GCF, and we're open to seeing much bigger type of requests coming in for investment. In that sense, we analyzed proposals in light of 6 investment criteria that were developed by the fund, by the board of the fund. And there's one in particular that, without wanting to take too much of your time, I wish to sort of make a special emphasis on, and that is the investment criteria as it relates to sustainable development potential. All projects are screened requesting that we see a strong linkage and wider benefits and priorities as they relate to sustainable development potential of the investment that is being brought to for consideration by the fund. And that means that the coverage of this includes environmental co-benefits, social co-benefits, economical benefits, as well as gender-sensitive development and impacts. There is, of course, a set of very specific outcomes that could be expected side by side with this co-benefits. For example, the expected social and health impacts as they relate to social co-benefits with regards to the result areas of the fund and in line with the national priorities and sectoral priorities that a country might have. So we think the GCF, the existing framework for investment is... It's welcoming of this conversation, and we just encourage again countries to take this opportunity and be the ones in the driving seat in bringing these priorities to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that intervention. And there you have it, an opportunity with the Green Climate Fund. And just to quickly recap, in terms of this criteria that you've raised, the sustainable development potential of the elements of the work that you're doing under the NAP, the National Adaptation Process, planning process. So, any reactions from the floor? Ali, I saw your hand. Please, go ahead.
Thank you. Ali Reza from IUCN. You know, still the discourse is as if adaptation and NAP processes and also the criteria, GCF, adaptation is different than development. That was the discourse we had 10 years ago when adaptation was taken just as an environmental issue. Mm-hmm. It has moved from there, and it's a survival and development issue. At one time, we discuss about poverty reduction and links with climate change, and then we say contribution or potential. So NAP, and again, I have a problem with the, you know, point two, the but. Over there, that are we taking adaptation, again, it has been discussed at end in itself. It's a means towards development. Poverty, poor people are the most vulnerable people in adaptation with adaptation deficits. So that discourse, and we need that paradigm shift, that it's a means towards sustainable local economic development. Mm-hmm. Then we will move towards SDGs and deal with the disasters. Otherwise, we may go in circles and came up with, different methodologies, tools, but we need to have a focused direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that. And I think you raised a really valid point in terms of the but in there. So I'm not sure whether we should put it in brackets. or not in brackets. Perhaps we need to reflect. But I want to go back to, Stefan, your point. You raised a very interesting point in terms of the architectural dynamic at the national level. So in terms of the governments in the House, can we heard the experience from Austria, similarly from the experience from the Netherlands. Can we hear some more experiences in terms of what's actually working at the national level in your respective countries? Or where it hasn't worked? We're still using Slido, right? Please, you can input your input on Slido, but I really want to hear your voices. Wow, see, we live in a perfect world. Or can I rephrase the question? So we heard from our my colleague from the Food and Agriculture Organization where he said, look, the realities are that governments at the national level are bombarded, are really busy, they are overwhelmed. So we're talking about this integration process and how is it working, different ministries, different approaches, what the different entry points are at the national. I mean, it's a maze that a lot of people are navigating through. So I would love to hear from you, particularly government representatives in the House, how they've navigated this landscape towards having to integrate, making sure that adaptation takes into the context of sustainable development goals and also the DRR Sendai framework. And towards the end of this session, I would like you to kindly either you post on Slido or you raise your hand so we can take note of it. We need your recommendations for next week. Next week, some of you are moving on from here to Cancun, Mexico, for the global platform on DRR. So what recommendations should be taken from this dialogue here to that conversation? I open the floor. Thank you.
Okay, well, what works? From the examples that I can think of in the Pacific, where there is a strong political will, strong political leadership to get this done is a good starting point. That sort of agreement that ministries have to work together, and then having a bit of a process on how to do that. Now Sione talked about the joint national action plans for disaster risk and climate change. Now, that has a guideline, and it has a sort of a process that countries can adopt. Once you've kind of established that sort of consensus, you then need to have responsible units or responsible committees to do the actual work. And most importantly, it needs to be done in such a way that the integration of and the mainstreaming becomes part of your daily job. You're not doing something extra. You need to have tools that allow you to do this automatically with your current work. Mm-hmm. That's not an easy task, I have to say, but that's really the only way that small administrations in the Pacific can do this. If it becomes an onerous burden, it'll fail. But really getting back to the first point is that there has to be this political drive to want to do this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that Pacific Island experience. Over to you, please, if you can introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm from Indonesia, from the Ministry of Environment and Forestry. In our view, that related institution line ministry deal with the CCA and DRR and also SDG should be sit together and talk each other. For example, in our country, we are in the process to develop a framework convergence of CCA and DRR. So from our office, Ministry of Environment and Forestry, work together with agency for disaster risk reduction, and also from the Ministry of Home Affairs, and also from the planning agency. So for these four line ministry mm-hmm. sit together and develop cooperation to integrate CCA and EDRR. And also, perhaps we can also include the SDGs, because the SDGs under the coordination of planning agencies.
Thank you. Wow, so you're already doing this. Well, good. Any other experiences?
We are in the process.
So it's in the process, it's happening. The gentleman in the middle there, please, if you can introduce yourself.
Yeah, Sabir Osman from Egypt. We have that experience with GIZ. We developed what is called advisory board for climate change in cities in order to guarantee that the exchange between the policymakers, practitioners, and local authorities about some important topics in order to catalyze and motivate the local authorities to take action towards climate change impacts and adaptation.
Thank you very much. And the lady in front here, please, if you can introduce yourself.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm not from a specific government. I'm from the Red Cross, Red Crescent Climate Center.
Thank you.
And I would like to bring to the table some experiences on the ground from the communities we work with. And from our experiences in different countries where we engage in NAPS, one of the, I think the first important step is to open the doors with other non-usual climate actors in the discussion. We found it very hard at first, but then very productive when communities or representative of communities are given a space in the table to discuss alongside government organizations, government agencies, and bring the vulnerability analysis that we see on the ground up in the national discussions. So I think that was one success story that I can think of right now in terms of engagement, in terms of process, having that inclusivity approach. Mm-hmm. And also at the local level, we found it easy for local government units and local officials if we have like simple checklists or tools that actually help them feel how integration is happening and how integration can happen in ways that they are not intimidated.
Right.
You see, at the local level, there's always this concept that, oh, climate change, that's so technical, I don't understand mm-hmm. that, or disaster, that's just about response. And I think we need to break that barrier by developing simple tools, simple narratives, which can actually connect to what the people are feeling on the ground and what they're experiencing. And that way they can actually take part of the process. So I think the integrated risk management approach from the tools itself up to the discussions up at the national level would be key in if we want to see this integration happen. And I think a last point from my end is something I forgot.
You will remember, because I'll just continue. I need to ask you a question. So now this experience that you had at the local government level, I've had some very exciting and interesting and also challenging experiences with local governments in different parts of the world. But I really want to hear from you. So did you manage to share some of these experiences with different, what you learned in one country and share that in another country? Is this something that the Red Cross, Red Crescent did, or how did you maneuver that?
It's happening right now.
Great.
We have global programs which allow us to share immediately the experiences in terms of integrated risk management approach. But just to zero in on a concrete local level example, I think one challenge we have is the planning process for DRR takes a framework that uses like disaster prevention, preparedness, response, recovery. That's the normal framework for disaster risk reduction planning. When you go to climate change adaptation planning, it goes through sectoral, and which is also linked to development processes. So immediately you see that divide. Immediately you see that apples and oranges kinds mm-hmm. of approach. And what we did on the ground was to try to explain, okay, what exactly does this sector in terms of the DRR framework? And it's not an easy thing, but slowly I think we're getting there
mm-hmm.
using innovative and participatory approaches. That's the only way for
Great.
For engagement to happen, if there's understanding and buy-in.
Great. No, thank you for that. And please do not forget to send us all your inputs on that email. And I'm sure the secretariat team are in touch with the Red Cross, Red Crescent team. But and everyone in this room, we did put up the email where you can send your input, because we need to get a lot of these background documents, background experiences, etc., and be able to share them widely as well. I do understand that there might be an intervention from the government of Korea, if the representative of the government of Korea is in the room. Please, over to you.
I'm sorry, but can I just clarify one thing? So,
go ahead.
Yes, I was about to deliver kind of outcomes of the conversation that we had yesterday. So,
I'm of the understanding that you had a prepared intervention?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So, but I'm not sure whether it's kind of in line with our conversations we have right at the moment. So maybe I can have my turn to have intervention later.
Okay. If that's okay. And then there might be someone also from the African Development Bank. Please.
I'm not from the Africa Development Bank, but I'm one of the Korean delegations, so I can maybe share some experience of
Korea. That'd be great
on
if
the
you can
NAP.
Do.
And then actually I'm not a government official, so I'm in an easier position to share my experience with you guys. So my name is Joo-yeon Kang. I'm from Korea Adaptation Center for Climate Change. So in Korea, we set up the National Adaptation Plan in a very early time. So we established our first National Adaptation Master Plan in 2010, which is a five-year rolling plan. So we set up the second Master Plan in 2015. So in my country, each in line ministry have to set up their own implementation plan according to the master plan. So for the first master plan, the 13 ministry participated with the Ministry of Environment as a coordinator of the whole adaptation agenda. But the thing is that the Ministry of Environment is not the strongest ministry of all. So it was difficult for us to monitor other ministries' tasks or their outcome. So what we did was that we tried to incorporate the monitoring and evaluation system in our second National Adaptation Master Plan, so that we want to see the outcome of the other ministries' adaptation activities. And we believe that this outcome will give us a very useful feedback into our master plan. So this is not a successful case yet, but I want to make emphasize on the importance of the reporting at least, or the monitoring of evaluation for the success of the National Adaptation Plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, the monitoring and evaluation is quite critical to really get a sense of what's happening. I would like to hear of a Latin American experience, because I'm not sure someone from Latin America has spoken. Or do we have anyone in here? Por favor. I don't think we do have... Do we have someone from the Latin American region? Okay, we don't. Any other experiences, opportunities? Please, Sylvia.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Vikander from the UN Environment World Conservation Monitoring Center. So again, not a country intervention, but I just wanted to build on this idea of knowledge sharing, which, you know, we were talking a bit about at the end of the session earlier, of how can we share the, you know, positive experiences and the challenges amongst the different countries so that everyone can, you know, understand what works and what doesn't work, and building on what you were saying. In a related but different integration effort that we've been working on. So at UNEP WCMC, we've been working with various African countries on integrating biodiversity and development strategies, so looking primarily at NBSEPs and whatever development plans exist nationally. And what has been a really successful model is the African Learning Group that we've been coordinating, and essentially it brings together both from within countries, people from, you know, the different ministries that need to be working together on thinking about biodiversity and development, but also the five or maybe seven different countries from sub-Saharan Africa, and brings them together to exchange their experiences in, you know, a week-long workshop. And that model has been really useful to, you know, work on integration within a country, between different ministries, but also between countries. And then, you know, it builds these contacts and links that persist, you know, beyond the workshops. And like I said, it's become a really successful model, and the countries are starting to invest in it on their own terms, and it's becoming a sustainable model of knowledge sharing. So I'm not sure if similar concepts exist in, you know, the conventions that we're discussing here, but it's certainly been useful with the countries that we've been working on, and we're trying to expand it to other African countries.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for that, Sylvia. Melissa, do you have your hand up? Please.
Hi. It's not an intervention country, of course, but I have been working like 1 year ago with communities in the highlands in Los Andes. And I can notice that most of the communities that are very small ones, like 20 families or 40 families or more sometimes, more of them usually doesn't know about any plant, especially with the NAPS plant. They don't know. They only think about what they can do daily, and also they are figured out like they are alone sometimes because they are at highest altitude, like 4,000 meters above the sea level. So usually they prefer to go to the cities, to go to the institutions to know about the plans that is going on there, because usually the government cannot reach these cities, well, these towns. No, so I consider that it's better to try to reach these places and try to talk with the people, because it's easier to work with them when they know you than doesn't have any idea what to do right now with the disaster that they have right now. Okay, thank you.
No, thank you very much. That ties in very well in terms of the communication. How do we raise awareness to say that whatever decision-making process you're engaged in deciding how you adapt or how you respond to a disaster or the preparedness that's done, and also in terms of the sustainable development goals, I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that in some of the places, communities in very remote areas are so unaware of this process. So how do we actually make sure that they are aware, and also there's a back and forth kind of communication so that they stay connected and not disconnected, and does not remain, for lack of a better term, and excuse me for this, does not remain an elitist conversation, because sometimes people are totally out of the picture. Please, the gentleman, if you can introduce yourself, sir.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Fakhri Karim from UNCDF. Just want to add a little bit. You see how hard to discuss where those planning should be integrated. Mm-hmm. As mentioned from the colleague from the FAO, there's many different sectoral planning process. So maybe we should start to see, look back, is it reasonable to expect all of those planning process or DRR SDG to be integrated in NAP? Or we look in different way, because besides DRR, SDG, and many other planning process, there is the overall development planning process in the country. Mm-hmm. If you take the case of Indonesia, we have the Ministry of Environment, other ministries have the planning, but then the BAPANAS, the planning agency, do the overall planning of the overall money. So then where all of this can be integrated? Should it be integrated in the development planning in the country with all the strategy? That's one. And then the other ones, when it's good to local level, as mentioned from colleague just now, it's too much for them to have 4 or 5 different plans. They just cannot afford to have a specific climate change plan, DRR, and SDG. For them, it's one plan, one local development planning process, where the government plan every year, they put the money in, and then they deliver. And then at the end, they might justify, oh, we did something on climate change, we did something on DRR at the end. But all only one planning, unless you want to go outside of it. Then you do something outside somewhere, and then after that we inform the government there, we have something outside there. Mm-hmm. So probably this is two things we need to look back. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you. You raised something that's... Beth, I'll just come to you in a second. Yesterday, when Martin actually presented... was it this morning? I think it was yesterday. It was yesterday, correct? Okay. I'm trying to see if you all wake up or if you're still awake. But yesterday he said something that was so interesting because, you know, coming from FAO, he said a farmer, when the farmer wakes up, doesn't say Monday is for DRR and Tuesday is for SDG and then Wednesday is for resilience building. A farmer is dealing with an ecosystem perspective. He gets there. Is my soil fertile? Is this going to feed my children? Is it going to make me money? Am I going to do... That is his thinking process. So even when we're planning these processes, and so going back to the bigger picture, the example that the lady gave from Indonesia, was it Malaysia? It was from Malaysia, I think, is for me pertinent in the sense that there's already something that's happening in the different, and which is why it's important for us to hear the experiences from different governments here, because something is happening, clearly, in terms of the integration, putting together the thought processes or whatever. How that is happening, the how, is what we want to hear. And who takes the responsibility? Because already, the lady at the back did say, the Korean counterpart, that the Minister of Environment was a weaker ministry in their country, and it's not an unusual circumstance. That we know for sure. So who's taking that responsibility, and how do we take that forward so that we now begin to feed into the bigger sort of process and also the negotiation process in particular? Beth, I give the floor over to you, please.
Thank you. And I just wanted to go back to a couple of points and reflect on our experience in Canada. We don't have, at the moment, a national adaptation plan, but we do have, recently, we established a pan-Canadian framework on clean growth and climate change, which includes an adaptation pillar. And that's, for the first time in Canada, that we have that now. And that relates back to the point that Espen was making earlier about the importance of political leadership, because for many, we've been working on adaptation for a long, long time, but the political stars aligned within the last few years between our federal and our provincial governments, and we were for the first time able to get agreement on this. So I would say the importance of political leadership is not to be underestimated. However, as we all know, governments change, and we could be in a different situation in a few years. Hopefully not, but maybe. So that's where the importance of thought leaders and other leaders from outside government comes into place, because if you can get private sector leaders or academic leaders to maintain the charge, even if your political situation changes, it's much harder to stop the work that you've undertaken. I also wanted to go back a little bit to the point about the legal framework. We are in a similar situation as Austria. We because of our constitutional situation, we would not be able to set any kind of legal framework at the federal level to influence local governments, subnational and local governments, in terms of adaptation because of the jurisdictional divisions that we have. However, that doesn't mean that there aren't very important things that we can do at the national and federal levels to enable the other levels of government to do their job. And one of there's essentially three things. The first one is data and information. We hold a lot of the climate data and a lot of other relevant information, and we can do a better job of making that available and making sure that other people can use it, access it, and use it. The other thing is capacity building. We can fund other levels of government to take that information and be able to apply it to their situations. And the third one is to make sure our federal house is in order. That means integrating it into all our policies and programs, so there's sort of a trickle-down effect. So I just wanted to make the point that even in the absence of legal framework, there are very important things that national governments can and probably should be doing.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Over to you again, please.
Yes. You were asking earlier and for a specific example on what the gentleman there talked about in terms of integration and planning processes. So let me share with you my experiences in the Philippines. In the Philippines, what they did, at especially at the local level, local government units are mandated to develop DRR plan, climate change action plan, and development plan. So these three plans, what the government did was that the DRR and the climate change action plan need to be integrated into the comprehensive development plan. So there's only one comprehensive development plan and comprehensive land use plan, but these are informed by both the DRR and the local climate change action planning. So you find the integration of all the three in the development planning document, which contributes upwards to the national development plan. It's an ongoing process. It's still a big challenge in a lot of local government units because of understanding and lack of processes and that kind of thing. But I think in at the onset, you already can see small successes in terms of the integration. And then you move backward steps further. Before the DRR plan and the local climate change action plan are developed, the vulnerability analysis that is used in both plans are informed by integrated risk management approaches, which means it has the DRR, the climate change, and even the ecosystem-based lenses in it in terms of vulnerability analysis. And so you are able to integrate at various scales and at different levels. So just one example of how this is happening and can happen at the local and national level.
Thank you for that example from the Philippines. The gentleman at the back, please, if you can introduce yourself, sir.
Yes, madam, thank you very much indeed. Colleagues, thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. My name is Gareth Phillips, and I'm from the African Development Bank. And I wanted to tell you that together with several African and other developing countries, we've been working on the creation of an innovative financial instrument for promoting both public and private sector investment in adaptation actions. It's called the Adaptation Benefit Mechanism, or ABM. Now, the ABM will help developing countries achieve their adaptation objectives in their NDCs and NAPs, and also contribute to achieving the global goals on adaptation of the Paris Agreement, the commitments of developed countries to provide climate finance, as well as the Sustainable Development Goals and the objectives of the Sendai Framework. How does it work? In short, project developers respond to the adaptation needs and priorities of host countries expressed in their NAPs and NDCs through initiating bottom-up projects that would not have happened otherwise, such as the installation of solar water pumps in a local community. In order to cover the project costs, the results are verified and certified and sold to investors or sponsors. For instance, one certificate or unit could stand for 100% access to drinking water for one household for 1 year, renewable over a 5-year period. After which the technology would be sustainably established. And consequently, each unit will have a story and will contain data on the adaptation impacts that it has. Therefore, the adaptation benefit mechanism is a results-based finance model for credible and transparent financing of adaptation actions, facilitating quantification of finance for adaptation and the impacts of adaptation measures. And this is very important for international climate finance community, providing evidence of how their climate finance was spent and the concrete results that were achieved. Madam, the units could be bought by donors, CSR buyers, impact investors, and even the general public, and surrendered as evidence of contribution towards adaptation and resilience objectives in NDCs or NAPs, or goals for provision of climate finance. Co-chairs, colleagues, we need to find a place for such a mechanism under the Paris Agreement. It will fill a gap which currently exists and for tools to mobilise private sector finance for adaptation. And consequently, I would hope to see a space for the adaptation mechanism and reflected in the report from this meeting as an innovative instrument to transform and improve the resilience of vulnerable communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gareth. I was actually looking for you earlier. Thank you so much for that intervention. We do have an email address that you can obviously feed into, and then that information can be shared with different colleagues and here and beyond the boundaries of the walls of this room. I understand there's also another intervention from somebody from the Global Environment Facility. Dustin, are you here? Oh, there you are, please.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to speak briefly. I understand that this session is supposed to bring together everything that has been discussed before, and so that includes NEPS, but my understanding is it will also go beyond NEPS. But the National Adaptation Plan process, in the Chef's point of view, really is a means to reaching the ambition stated in the NDC. It's a means to integrating climate change adaptation into development that it will then allow the country to reach the targets or objectives stated in the NDC under the Paris Agreement. And the Paris Agreement is just one of the MEAs, the multilateral environmental agreements, that has an ambition gap. There are others too, such as the Convention on Biological Diversity or the UNCCD. The CHEF is a financial mechanism for all of those. And even though we have supported NAP processes with around $41-42 million so far, we are also looking towards the next replenishment cycle, the seventh replenishment of the CHEF Trust Fund. And in that regard, we have put forward a proposal that aims to integrate the NDC as part of the national economic strategies and to really allow countries to translate the targets under the Sustainable Development Goals and the 2030 Agenda into the national level, hand in hand with the targets and the objectives under the multilateral environmental agreements, including also the Paris Agreement. So we are trying to look at this from a more holistic perspective going forward, since this is what countries put forward in their NDCs. We have analyzed NDCs, over 140 of those so far, and we basically came up with impact programs, the one I just mentioned, and also impact programs to address the needs such as food and agriculture systems to address the NDCs. And that goes hand in hand with the National Adaptation Plan. The NAP projects that the CHEF supported so far were above $3 million, just to follow up on the presentation from the Green Climate Fund representative earlier, mainly due to the fact that the projects are country-driven and included investment components in addition to the technical assistance for NAP processes per se. And that is because often for informed decision-making or to integrate climate change adaptation into development frameworks, the first step is to really look at the climate change impacts and gather also weather and climate information data, for example. So some of these projects have included investments in climate information services hand-in-hand with NAP process development. And The CHEF is supporting also the implementation of the Paris Agreement through the Capacity Building Initiative on Transparency, which will help measure progress in implementing the NDCs, and that includes also adaptation, very importantly. So since we're trying to pursue a balanced approach under the Paris Agreement, so far, as parties are aware, we have received over $55 million in pledges under the CBIT, and we have approved the first set of projects and welcome submission of additional project proposals. This should then also help strengthen NDCs going forward and hopefully match them with the NAP process that is being carried out in the countries as well. So I'll stop here, ready to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any clarifications from the floor? I think they're very clear, even our counterpart from Africa Development Bank, that was pretty clear. The lady from South Korea, please.
Thank you. Now I hear the floor mentioning about land, food, government, leadership, resources, and experiences from Philippines, UNCCD thing, and I think this is the right time to deliver the outcomes of the conversation that we had yesterday. So Thank you very much for giving me the floor. I'm Pyeonghwa Yoon from the Republic of Korea, working in the Korea Forest Service. And there was a conversation co-organized by UNFCCC and UNCCD secretariats, the Republic of Korea, under the topic of why land degradation neutrality, which is LDN, matters for climate. The meeting was honored by the presence of Mr. Kim, the Consul General of Republic of Korea in Bonn, and Mr. Nick Nuttall, Coordinator of Communication and Outreach of the UNFCCC, Dr. Pradeep Monga, and Mr. Kim from the Korea Forest Service, and Marcus. And especially, the conversation was especially honored by the large audience and diverse participation. And the conversation has as panelists representatives from Dominican Republic, Ghana, and Philippines, which are steadily advancing the implementation of the Paris Agreement and the achievement of land degradation neutrality. The discussion focused on how commitments, policies, and implementation under different frameworks of action of the three Rio Conventions in the context of the SDGs can programmatically deliver breaking the soils and fragmented landscape of governance and investments. And the conversation particularly focused on the role of LDN as a powerful tool to deliver multiple benefits, including climate change. Participants put emphasis on its LDN implementation relates to not only mitigation, but more also to adaptation. We learned that, for example, Dominican Republic relies on the restoration of land in climate action and needs to identify the critical areas to cooperate. We learned that Ghana recognized the economic benefits of LDN and puts its people and farmers at the center of implementation of LDN. We also learned that the Philippines, one of the most vulnerable countries to the adverse effects of the climate change, reflect adaptation as the main strategy in their INDC and implement sustainable land management to achieve LDN as a platform of adaptation. The conversation noted that the importance and power of advocacy and education to enhance understanding of people and participation in LDN implementation. The conversation also emphasized that we must acknowledge people-centered approach, recognition of the economic case of inaction, and focusing on food security, which is the basis of our lives, are to pave for our action in land degradation neutrality. Thank you for giving the floor.
Thank you very much, Yu. Sincerely appreciate for that intervention. Are there any thoughts, off the floor experiences? Please, if you can introduce yourself, ma'am.
Thank you. Katy Chachibaye from UNDP. Actually, I had prepared intervention, but for the group session.
You are very welcome to express your thoughts.
Sorry, I'm imposing myself, but I was thinking.
That's okay.
I need to come in at this point. Some of the important points have been already made in relation to NAPS, but I just want to make a very short intervention about UNDP's take on NAP process, because we are supporting many countries across various regions. And Austrian gentleman from Austria mentioned that, and I want to reiterate that NAP indeed is not a standalone, isolated planning process, or at least this is our take on this. It rather kind of tags on existing planning exercises, planning cycles, in a given country, whether it's a national level, or sectoral, or subnational level. And I think that fits the purpose of what governments want to do the best, instead of overloading already very tedious planning systems in the country and the governance structures and bringing additional planning exercise. I think the best way to go forward, at least based on our experience in some cases, is to embed the NAP process, which actually means to provide adaptation content to the existing planning processes. That concretely means to provide climate risk information, And then if it happens at the local level, sub-national level, you have to provide locally calibrated climate risk information because national level scenarios are not really fitting into what the local authorities or the communities need to prioritize. And to help them in prioritization exercise, in costing, cost and benefit analysis or economic valuation, and then through the prioritization, costing, and finally budgeting. So basically NAP is a vehicle to make sure that adaptation priorities are integrated into the planning and budgeting processes across the board, across the sectors, or across the vertical axis of the planning. And I think the fundamental question, how effective NAP is, relates to the governance structures existent in the country and how much of already well-established, well-guided planning systems already exist in the country. And also the question of level of decentralization comes up very importantly when it comes to the local subnational planning. In certain countries, for example, Nepal now is undergoing very serious institutional reforms, and there is a very strong push towards the decentralization. They have the system and the processes in place, so the district district committees that are mandated to create very engaging and participatory planning process and feeding up towards the national level, and that's the ideal setup for the NAP to come in and to provide the adaptation content into it. I think that's important to understand that it's very country-specific. NAP is shaped based on what is the governance structure, what are the planning processes and cycles, what are the guidelines. NAP basically provides the services of adaptation content, and I think this shouldn't be taken lightly because it's not only one singular step. We integrate and we are done. It has to be very iterative, and therefore through the NAP process we have to develop the capacities, how the risk information is generated, what are the institutional services that can deliver that, what are the internal capacities for cost-benefit analysis or economic valuations for adaptation measures, prioritizations. So these technical capacities, both in terms of human resources, but also in terms of institutional mandates, should be put in place very strongly. And I think NAP is very well placed to be the process, but also to be a vehicle of this kind of capacity development on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you, Katia. Thank you so much. In fact, you raised something towards the end when you say that it has to be an iterative process. As I mentioned earlier this morning, I said we have to bear in mind that this is a living document, you know, or process even. You know, it's we go back, we revisit, and circumstances change. And also the governance element is very critical. Beth has just gone, but Beth did mention something that was quite critical in terms of sometimes the political shifts can also sometimes change the dynamic in terms of what's actually happening. So we have to take and be cognizant of that. We are now moving towards the end of this session before the Executive Secretary of the UNFCCC comes in the next 10 minutes. So I want to take and use this 10 minutes wisely and wonderfully with you all to really now think very critically in terms of the recommendations. What are your thoughts? What messages should we be sending next week to the Global Platform on DRR? I know some of you in this room are going to be there. It would be good to just get some thoughts from the floor if you want to use it on Slido. And I'll just take a moment maybe to read two elements from some of the take-home messages that you're posting on Slido. For instance, you know, the post-development agreements. Okay, I shall read the next one, I suppose. the post-2015 development agreement should be accessing and using the same data for decision-making. This came out very much, I think, even yesterday in terms of coherence, matrices, etc. We heard from the example from Japan. This will ensure coherence in actions. The boat has two holes in it, and both have to be dealt with. So you just don't plug one, otherwise it's going to fill in with water and still sink. So how do you manage that? The one hole represents the need to build resilience at the national level, but equally important, the only way to reach success is to build resilience at the local level. The monitoring process is well balanced with the Sendai framework, and monitoring of the Paris Agreement should be leveraging this as an ongoing process. And this is what Katia has actually said, you know, the iterative process and making sure that the wheel is oiled nicely and wonderfully. They're still coming on, still coming in. Please keep sending your messages. Any reactions, any recommendations that we can take from the floor? Next steps? What should you be feeding into the negotiation process? People from the back, perhaps? I can see your devices are busy clicking on taking pictures, but I'd like to hear your voices. I see another take-home message. If you can just, I'll use my Slido, I suppose. If you can just scroll down. I think there was one that was talking about implementation at the community level. Is that litmus? Supposed to be a litmus test for the coherence of national policies related to adaptation, DRR, and achieving the SDGs. I think that's a valid point. That came up yesterday in our conversations. There's also the issue of developing plans for adaptation, sustainable development, and disaster risk reduction doesn't need to be and should not be duplicative. And I think we've heard some experiences in the House both yesterday and today on how that is happening, but also how it's not happening. An integrated approach will enable progress towards all and likely to result in better and more effective solutions and ease the reporting burden. It is possible! Exclamation mark. I do like that. Yes, it is doable. And I think we've seen some examples from governments, from different countries in the House that are doing different arrangements and how different entry points as well. Any reactions from the House? Recommendations, please? Sylvia.
Yeah, seeing all of this and thinking about the discussions today, I think we should remember to keep something important from the discussions yesterday in this and the recommendations, which is the role of ecosystems. Because I think this came through not only in the breakout group yesterday on ecosystem resilience, but from a lot of countries mm-hmm. that were intervening and giving us examples. And as we were saying, you know, healthy ecosystems underlie sustainable development, and I think that's just something, you know, a point that should be reflected in all of this so that we don't lose track of the, you know, sort of underlying source of sustainable development, really. So if we can integrate that in some manner, that would be great, also for next week's platform.
Thank you. Thanks. That's a thought that you can actually feed into the Slido and would take that into consideration. Anyone in the group? Romaru?
Thank you very much. I think some of the take-home messages is the understanding of how adaptation in the main reinforces sustainable development. But again, how do we harness the various frameworks without necessarily doing duplications? To ensure that they are mutually reinforcing in terms of us taking adaptation forward. What I think came out as well is the element around understanding the additional value of adaptation to a normal sustainable development trajectory, mm-hmm. how it starts to help in terms of building that resilience, reducing those vulnerabilities, particularly the climate risks, to deal with the issues of development. Yeah, I think those were very great takeaway messages. The coordination mechanisms came through as well. So we're looking forward to the technical paper and the consolidation of the messages from this workshop. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that input. Anyone else? The lady over there, sorry, I had my back against you.
Thank you. I'm sorry if this was already said yesterday. I couldn't partake due to conflicting appointments. What I'm missing here a bit, and this is what we have been hearing now from the floor, is how do we take into account communities? And I'm still missing this here. So from our work at GIZ, I will propose the following. It would be to take into account gender and vulnerable groups considerations and mainstream this into the NAP process. Of course, the NAP process as the vehicle that already includes disaster risk reduction, that includes the delivery of the adaptation goals in the NDC, that also, of course, when implementing the NAP process, we take into account SDGs. So basically, just to put it in a very small sentence, include gender, comma, vulnerable groups, indigenous communities, considerations in mainstreaming NAP process, and then
can you input that into Slido?
Yeah, of course.
Yes, please. If you can input that, we'll be more than grateful. Because okay. That's really critical that we capture that. I know that there is a comment in there about communities. I think there was one that was down further down because we can't see the entire screen. Mm-hmm. But it's critical that whatever thoughts you have, please include it on Slido so that we capture it and keep it for use.
And maybe, sorry, if you just go might finish that thought. I don't want to reopen the whole best practices from the ground because, as you said, I sadly missed that session. But just as a pointer, what we're doing in that sense is that we are integrating these considerations in our work through different tools in the implementation, but we're also having these people through their representatives mm-hmm. partake in all the steps from the NAP process. And I think this is a very good approach, and I'm happy if anybody has questions afterwards to talk that in the hall.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Karim.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure if you already hear the important role of subnational government in two things. One, all of those policy can be integrated in subnational government planning process at the local level. And the other thing is the important role of subnational government to link NAPs to the implementation at the local level. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else in the room to make an intervention? Any final word? Wow, just on time. Great. It's been a really fantastic discussion, and we're going to consolidate all of this, share all of this, and put the thoughts together. And please remember the email. David, if you can still put it there for colleagues who are coming in, who did manage to capture the email, please send us your background documents. There was a lot of rich information coming out of this discussion and the earlier discussions. And please share with us all your documentation. We really would like to have that.